outside the box of religious obligation lies a road less travelled, into the heart of the Father's affection. Slinging freedom all over the place, this is the God Gym.
Wayne, I got to pound my chest in the wilderness and smoke a cigar this last weekend.
Really? You have to talk about that. Really, that's how you want to start.
Oh, absolutely. Why not?
I've been gone for 3 months. This is the best opening you got.
I know how much you love the iconic stereotype of men going into the wilderness and smoking cigars and beating their chests.
Makes me question your salvation, Kyle.
No, got the privilege and joy of getting to go up to the cabin with eight guys from, oh man, let's see here. We had Missouri, Michigan, Florida, and Wyoming that were all up there. And just a really cool 4.5 days of guys getting together around the activity of fly fishing and the outdoors, but more so just an opportunity for guys to be able to connect and engage with one another and to let down their guards and just to enjoy some good time together. And it was an incredible experience. I mean, guys in different stages of life, different experiences, different connections in their journey with Christ. And yet to hear the heart longings that each guy brought to the trip was pretty incredible. It was quite an opportunity to be able to do that. And it's amazing what walls drop when you are not connected to the matrix 24/7, because there's no cell service up there. You have to drive roughly 10 miles to be able to get cell service. And wow. So to be able to be on an alpine lake at just over 10,000 feet with nobody around, no cell service, and just getting to enjoy some beauty and some community, it was an incredible opportunity.
How do other people get included in this invite if they desire to go into the mountains naked and beat on their chest and whatever else you do?
Well, that's a great question. I've been actually talking with some people about possibly opening up and doing a few more of these in the summers. And so if there would be interest in that, then I would love to hear from you. So if you want to email me, because I know that there's been some additional interest in that. And this was just more of just a group of guys that had come together almost 4 years ago, actually. And we had a couple of new additions, but for the most part, it was a returning group. And man, just to be able to encourage one another and some of us for the first time having seen each other in 4 years and to be able to reconnect in that way was pretty awesome. But yeah, if there's interest out there, this is something that is on my heart, being able to facilitate and create opportunities for guys to be able to unplug and be able to just enjoy the outdoors, enjoy adventure, and enjoy community. Let me know, because I would love to hear from you.
Okay, great. So there you go. If you want to join Kyle and his wasteland of disaster, whatever.
It was a little interesting because Wyoming has reintroduced the wolf a long time ago into Yellowstone, and they're like, oh well, you know, it's gonna stay in the park. Well, obviously they have not. They've right. been saturating Idaho, Wyoming, Montana. I knew that they had gotten down into the snowies down where our cabin is at, which is way southern Wyoming. I mean, it's fairly close to the Colorado border. We had wolves howling at us from across the lake, which was an interesting experience. And to know that there was a pack of wolves across the lake.
Glad you had fun. I'm Wayne Jacobson.
And I'm Kyle Rice.
And I'm home from the road finally after 81 days and 14 states or 18 states and 25 different campsites.
What does it feel like to land back at home, especially your new home? I mean, this is kind of your first venture out and then coming back to this new space that you and Sarah have created, right? From the apartment to here?
No, we did a 6-week trip last fall and came back to it.
Oh, that's right.
Mandy really enjoyed it. It was a little bit, I think she was a little young to take a pup in an environment in which she's contained in an RV all day or on a leash all day and has no opportunity to just go run and celebrate life. So she came home. She's been a little nuts.
She's kind of had the permanent zoomies, huh, since you've gotten back?
She's got a lot of zoomies and a lot of attitude, and we're having to sit on that little dog a bit and teach her how to have some manners now that she's home. The training continues. Yeah. What's the best thing you heard this week, Mr. Kyle?
Oh, so I got into a podcast, which I think we may dive into a little bit more here in a little bit, but it was by Meg J, and I'm sure we can post the link on the page. Man, it was a really cool podcast. I was just looking for something to listen to this morning, and I saw it come up on my feed, and it was about 20-somethings, and I'm always intrigued when I'm looking at, you know, a developmental section of life, and especially this one, because I work with a lot of 20-somethings. It's a, I mean, both at the college and in my coaching stuff, and so I want to hear different people's opinions. Well, Meg J is a clinical psychologist. She actually specializes in working with 20-somethings and the whole adulting process. And one of the quotes that came up from this podcast was a question that I absolutely loved. And I wish I would have known to ask this question in this level of clarity when I was in my 20s. And that question was, what growth experiences do you think I need? What would be something that 20-somethings can actually ask their support group? So either mentors or people that are walking alongside of them that are a bit down the road a little bit farther, people that are in their support network, what would be something to ask them? And that question of what growth experiences do you think I need came up. And I locked onto that, especially as a college professor and being connected to this age demographic. I was like, oh my gosh, that is amazing.
Give me a for instance, if a 20-something came to you in your college class and said, Kyle, what kind of growth opportunity do I need this summer?
Well, first, I would need to know the person. I mean, again, this would be something that would come as a byproduct of relationship. So me knowing their journey, knowing their experience. One of the things that I would encourage them would be to be curious. So don't specialize in your 20s. I know there are areas of our culture and our society that strongly encourage 20-somethings and late teens to specialize. So find that thing, find that niche, find that passion, and go and become the best at it in your 20s. And yet, I feel like that is such a recipe for burnout, for isolation, for tunnel vision. Instead, I would say when an opportunity arises that you're curious about, say yes to it. Whether it's something that you are completely in love with or not, I think a lot of your 20s is finding things that you're like, oh, well, I didn't really like that. And so, but you went out and tried it versus that seems a little scary. So I'm not going to try and I'm going to stay in this very, very tight lane and not move forward. So that would be one thing. If I think about myself and in my 20s, and if I had a mentor that asked, what growth experiences do you think that I need? One that I would respond to myself would have been, Kyle, don't be a salesman. So growing up, I had to sell everything. So I kind of would talk around things, or I'd make things more glamorous than they were, or I would skirt around the truth, or I would give partial truths because I would want to sell the idea. I would want to sell this thing because that was the only way that I was able to get any kind of permission in a very, very strict environment to start exploring who I was. So I had to have done the research and explored it and presented my argument in the best form possible, which doesn't, honestly, it doesn't allow for failure. It doesn't allow for self-curiosity. It doesn't allow for critical thinking skills, and it doesn't allow for self-esteem. Show up and say it straight, be forward and honest. Even if it is a failure, even if you do accidentally step on somebody's toes, don't dance around things. Show up, be honest, be true.
Okay. First thing that came to my mind when you said, what kind of experience does someone need to challenge their life or whatever. My first thought was, for my life, go find a wonderful friend and let them betray you in the most horrible way. And I don't even mean that cynically. Those are the things that have changed my life. And I think of Tom Moen's podcast I do. And one of the earliest ones we did back 20 some odd years ago, he talked about the things God uses to shape our lives. And one of those is a betrayal of a very close friend. And I go, you know what? That's nothing you'd want to recommend to someone to go do. But if it happens to you, find the process in it. Find what God would do through that, because that's a life shaper for sure. And if you let it change you, it can change you. And if you don't, it will own you for the rest of your life. You'll be defensive and guarded, and you'll never trust anyone ever again because betrayal hurts so much. But when you find that God's bigger than the betrayal, then you won't be so afraid of it. Is that crazy?
It's not. So the question that comes to my mind, though, is Do you think that in your 20s, your relationship with God would have had the capacity to handle that level of betrayal? So say you did that. Say you went and did an internship in your early 20s, right? And got betrayed by a close friend in a institutional Christian setting. Would your relationship with God had the capacity to move you into that invitation of, I have something more here for you?
I would hope the Holy Spirit would have enough to do that. I wouldn't trust my ability to do that or have my capacity, but I would trust if it happens to me, mm-hmm. then the Holy Spirit has a way to navigate. It might be a few years of anguish and anger and vengeance and seething and before the grace settles in that allows mm-hmm. you to manage it and handle it and allow the negative to transform you. But yeah, I wouldn't be trusting my capacity to get through that anyway. Because I wasn't ready when it happened to me.
No, I think that's very fair. I think what I was getting at with that question is, especially like we've been talking a lot about the journey that you've been on with Father and those relational building blocks, those deep foundational building blocks of trust that positioned you in a space where your heart could respond in a different way when, for example, when Sarah left mm-hmm. or when the situation with a family member came up. Yep. Those things, you had a lot of context, a lot of trust, a lot of foundation that had been built relationally with Father that helped you be able to navigate those things. And obviously, he came in and stepped in a very, very big way for you in those times. At least personally, for me, I think about in my 20s and man, I like some of the things that I've dealt with in my late 20s, mid 30s, even late 30s, thinking back to 20, 21, 22, I don't know if I would have had the relational rapport with Father to even look for the Holy Spirit to be moving in that space.
Yeah, I certainly didn't in my first experience with this. I had some when I was younger. Betrayal seems to be the nature of human interaction from people that are less than pursuing Jesus, right? Because we all had bad experiences in school where some friend said one thing and did something else or gossiped about you in a way that was destructive. So my thought was to be where I was in my 60s to handle the big stuff that came. I would think now, hey, get on that road early because early and often you're going to have opportunity to deal with betrayal.
Yeah.
So that would be my thought is it'd be good to get started on that road in your 20s, even if the first 5 years is bitterness and hostility until it moves you to a place of freedom and where Jesus and his Spirit begins to work in your heart. But man, those have been the most transformative things in my life. I would not be who I am today without those experiences, I'm sure.
And I think that falls into one of the advice points that Meg said that she often gives to young people, to 20-somethings that are starting in this journey. And it's the idea of building identity capital versus going out and specializing in a job or finding the answers to very specific questions. She talks about the idea of building identity capital. You're growing in that sense of self, of morality, of relational capacity, of relational ability. And what that looks like in the real world. What does that look like to actually develop those things and to go through those experiences?
Yeah, she talked about that too in contrast to an identity crisis, right?
Yes.
Instead of wallowing in an identity crisis, build some identity capital, which is explore some things that help you come to grips with who you are and have a little more confidence in, I would say, God's ability to work through you, though that's not what they said, obviously. But I think that because one of the big contrasts I talked about was the uncertainty of life in the age of 20.
Yes.
The grasp for certainty, which is just not a good grasp to go for because it's not a real thing, certainty. And I think so then what you want to develop is that relational capital or competence. You have competence to negotiate difficult things. You have a competence to maintain being true to yourself when the pressure is to fake it up to get by with the people you're with. I think that's a much better way to view how life comes at us than this constant quest for certainty? And how can I insure myself enough or do enough to make sure my life, my ducks are all in a row? And then find out that you can have all your ducks in a row and then discover they're not even in the same pond together. Life can turn on a dime, as they say.
I thought that was really interesting because she really highlighted the level of uncertainty that is present in the 20s. So whether that be major relationships, either friendship or life partner, romantic relationships, career-wise, financials. I mean, she talked about a lot of these big questions or these uncertainties. And yet, man, I feel like that is, if you can learn to deal with and be at rest, be at peace in that space of uncertainty, what an incredible skill to have your entire life, right? Because that's, I feel like that's one of those identity capital elements that's so important, is if you're able to live in the tension of uncertainty and not panic, not have to force something into existence, not trying to manufacture in something in your own strength, but be able to trust in that relational journey that God has you on. What an incredible skill set to have, because in my 30s, my late 30s, there's still a lot of uncertainty. Now, granted, some of those big life questions that 20 somethings are asking, I have had settled, but in regards to a level of uncertainty, it's constantly present.
Especially the world we grew up in. Yeah. And that's a real shift in generations. The generation before us, you know, graduated high school, went into their father's profession usually,
yeah,
stayed with the same firm, union job, mining job, farming, whatever. You did it for 45 years, you retired. Today, my generation was a lot more fluid in terms of did this for a decade and then switched to this for a decade. And because technology was so shifting the job market that you had to be more flexible. I didn't have to be. And I also noticed the generational difference between what she was saying, what's unresolved in your 20s, like who you're going to love and raising kids and what you're going to do for a living. All that was resolved for me at 22.
Really? Okay.
And that would be true, I think, of most in my generation. You went to college, yeah. You got married, you were usually with a college sweetheart, and you began your life. Now, all that didn't work out well for everybody, but you pretty much targeted the job you wanted. And then the early 20s is settling into that job, whether it's teaching, whatever it is, finance. Like if you go to med school, man, you talk about don't be too specialized in your 20s. Well, if you're going to go to med school, you've got 12 years of education. So you better know what you want and specialize early to find your way through that. So I think it's a real difference between our generation, which moved into the 20s, embracing adulthood, embracing the responsibilities of now raising a family. We had our two kids by the time Sarah was 25. And now we're raising kids at a young age and we don't know much that we're doing. And you know, the job situation. I didn't really reach a chronic state of vocational or relational uncertainty until my early 40s.
Hmm.
That would have been my first taste of it. The betrayal of a co-pastor friend. And now I don't know where finances are coming. I don't know vocationally what I want to do anymore. The family thing was still intact. That didn't happen until my 60s. But yeah, it's just listening to all that saying, gosh, that resolve was made at a much younger age in my generation.
That is one of the interesting parts about that. She actually didn't address a ton. She kind of mentioned it a little bit, but especially in the work that I've done, both in mental health as well as just in the college world, that developmental timeline seems to keep getting pushed back later and later and later. So decisions that people were making in their early 20s, in your, should I say era? No, in your generation.
Watch your mouth. Phil, make me come over there.
In your generational time, and even in my parents' generation, that was, I mean, my parents, my mom was 20 and my dad was 24 when they got married. My mom was 21 when she had me. I mean, they started raising a family very early on. And so that was a cultural system, a cultural value that I grew up hearing a lot, like get married young, find that career, get plugged in quickly, settle into that lifestyle, settle into that career, figure it out. And now they're not even starting a lot of that exploration process until their late 20s, early 30s. I know, especially on the West Coast, a lot of the late 20, early 30 somethings were just now starting to have, I would say, some of the conversations that you were having, that your generation was having from 19 to 25. And they're having it at 30 to 35.
Yeah, I went to college because specifically the thing I wanted to train for. I didn't go to college to explore options because I would have chosen a different path. If I'd done what I wanted to do, I wouldn't have even gone to college. I would have gone elsewhere. But going into college to train for quote unquote ministry, I wouldn't use the term in the same way today. But to me, back in the day, that was looked on as normal. Mm-hmm. The people had no clue what they wanted to do. Why are you even in college spending money on a degree if you don't know what you want to do with it? Like one friend of mine, his daughter graduated from a very expensive private school and told her dad she wanted to be a flight attendant after $140,000 of education or whatever. And he said, oh, no, you don't. Not after putting all that to it. I think this is a tendency for our generation to judge younger people, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. If you weren't on your life path by 23, 24, then you were a slacker, unmotivated. It would be looked at very negatively. And I think young people feel that negativity from a generation that, I don't know, had more options or just a different initiative in their life. What's built into the motivation of my generation that isn't built into the motivations of a generation today that doesn't even want to ask those questions until they're in their 30s? I just don't even know how to grasp that.
Part of it was your parents went through the Great Depression, went through World War II.
Yep.
And so having a job was a privilege. There's 50 million options that are sitting in front of you. To have a job that paid the bills for your family was a major privilege. And so I think that was definitely a different shaping, a different perspective than what current generations are facing, for sure. I think it was also really interesting when she made the comment about the stat of that between 20 and 35, during that period of time, the average is 9 different jobs. I mean, if you had 9 jobs between 20 to 35 in your generation, if that came up on a resume, you would never get hired because they would think you were super flaky, that you had no loyalty, no company commitment at all. And so that would be a major red flag to a hiring committee, right?
Yeah, I had 9 jobs before I was 22 between summer work and college work and trying to put myself through stuff. But I think that motivation is highly valued. I think people who want to get on a career path in their late 30s or mid 30s, you know, you've lived half your life, most likely, and you haven't found a trajectory that you can pursue with some passion and some excitement and build a life from that. So I still don't know what's different now and whether it's expectations or just what's not normal. We normalized an inability to ask those questions in your late teens. We did it in high school. What do you want to do vocationally? Mm-hmm. And that determines where you go from school. It's vocational or what. Now it's the pressure to send everybody to university and steer them away from vocational things when AI is going to replace most of the skills that university gives you, and the plumbers will be the ones most coveted because AI can't fix your plumbing when you need it done.
That is absolutely true. And I think it's really interesting because I really liked that when she was looking at the developmental arc and she talked about how culture and society tells 20-somethings or people in their late teens going into their 20s that your 20s is going to be the best decade of your life, that you better enjoy it now because that's going to be the best decade of your life. And yet developmentally, social scientists are finding that actually developmental process, especially around identity and relational development, actually bottoms in your 20s and starts the climb out in your late 20s, early 30s. That's when you start to move into a more fulfilling, wholehearted space developmentally around those topics, which was really intriguing to me. Because I think it does set up, especially when I talk to 20-somethings and they're talking about the type of life they're experiencing and what their expectations are for the life they're supposed to be living, there is a lot of that pressure of man, I need to enjoy this. I need to be able to soak up as much of my 20s as I can, which is intriguing because I think that's why it's pushing that cultural norm is what's pushing a lot of those major life decisions into their mid to late 30s, where they're considering marriage, they're considering a family, they're considering a more stabilized career path in their 30s than they are in their 20s. Because like, oh no, you got to go live it up in your 20s. You got to have your best years possible in your 20s. And a lot of their minds, a lot of these individuals' minds, it's like, oh, okay, well, I'm going to go have fun. I'm going to go party. I'm going to go explore. I'm going to go do whatever. And I'm going to push the adulting conversations to the next decade.
See, I was never told the 20s are your best years. We were told high school is your best years. No responsibilities. Really? Yeah, you just go, you learn some things, you kind of sort out where you want to go. But yeah, for us, it was always high school or college. Sometimes people would say, hey, you better enjoy college because after that, it's all downhill. And it was fairly negative in the sense that, hey, this is fun and you're free and there's a lot of freedom. But once you get out and you have to pay rent, and you've got mm-hmm. to buy food, and now you've got to take responsibilities. And that was happening at 20 and 21. It wasn't happening at 29, 30, 31. And so I wonder if it's just a developmental thing in the brain, which she was seeming to suggest, or if it's just because cultural norms have shifted in a way that keeps people, because, and I would say, I don't think that's everybody, because I know young 20s who are in college on their way, have plans for a future, dating, feeling like, gosh, they've got a partner that's probably going to be in their lives. So I know a lot of people that kind of are on the similar time trajectory that Sarah and I were, but I realize there's a lot more that, I mean, marriage is so much later. An average age of marriage is way up in the upper 20s, low 30s. Where for us, it was more 21, 22. I wonder how much of that is just society norms have changed for what reason? Or is it really a matter of brain development that my generation was pushed too early to those things? But I don't hear anybody saying that. I don't hear my generation saying, boy, I wish we had more time to play it up in our 20s and do that stuff and not get down a career path and home ownership and doing some of the things that create a lifestyle that you can live a life on. I don't hear regret there.
I think so. One of the things that she made the comment about, and I wrote a note on, was parents pressuring young people to choose a career based on their parents' priorities versus helping their adult child identify their own priorities. I think that has been one of the cultural shifts that really has taken place starting in my generation. And then I think has carried on to the younger generations. In regards to a pretty significant shift in priorities. I mean, for example, I follow a couple of content creators that are in their mid-20s, and they constantly are talking about the new wealthy. And in their minds, that is no debt, no obligations, free to go wherever they want, exploration, life experiences, diversified relationships. And these are two individuals. One of them lives in a van and the other one lives in a truck and they travel all over the world. And that's what they do. And so I don't know if you've noticed this. Are you familiar with the homestead movement that's happening right now, specifically with millennials?
No, I'm not.
Okay. So there's this whole trend. I mean, it's almost getting to the point where it's comical because there's this whole trend talking about millennials and how they're moving towards this homesteading mentality, where they're wanting to move into the country, they're wanting to get a little plot of land, they're wanting to be able to be more self-sustaining in regards to raising their own cattle, raising their own chickens, raising their own vegetables. The really funny like thing that millennials are constantly getting made fun of is sourdough bread. And for whatever reason, becoming an artisan and making sourdough bread.
That I am aware of.
But there is a major shift that I've seen happening, specifically with people, my peers, that priority of not having the big, fancy, flashy car with all the toys and all the things. It's slowing down, simplifying, being more healthy, being more self-sustaining, more margin in your life. Those are big priorities that I see specifically in my generation, my peers, that's where they're investing their time. That's where they're investing their money. And it's becoming very intriguing.
I think that's far more healthy than the whole idea of, you know, getting the big house you can't afford and the cars you do to impress your neighbors. And your life is so complicated just maintaining things that mm-hmm. you don't enjoy life. I can appreciate the simplifying, the minimalistic things. Having grown up on a farm, I don't want my own chickens. I don't want my own goats. I don't want to weed my corn before I can eat it. I'm really okay with going to the supermarket on those things, but I don't despise those who go, man, there's kind of a romance to the idea of having your own land and having your own ability to feed and support yourself from that land. And as some people think, that may be a necessity in the next couple decades.
That's also true. And I think that's an interesting, but coming back to the idea of parents pressuring kids to meet their priorities. Like when you actually, that comment came up when you were talking about the parent that had the child that went to a very expensive private school and then says, oh, I'm going to go and do this career. I mean, the parent's response was very much, no, these are my priorities. This is the financial investment that I've made or that you've made. No, you're not allowed to do that. And yet, what if that's what brings them joy? What if that brings them to a wholehearted space? What if that's what they love doing?
Well, fortunately, in this case, it worked mm-hmm. out great. She's really okay. glad she didn't take that tack and okay. became a young mom and has kids and raised them. And so I think she's really grateful that that's not the arc she ended on. Okay. And maybe the parents knew that. It's part of their conversation with her. So I can go either way in terms okay. of whether that's a healthy thing or not. And I think it's an interesting conversation given what we shared last time in our podcast about holding this generation, this younger generation in prayer that God would give them hearts to know him. Yeah. I got this from Mike, a friend of mine in Ohio, has written this a few times. This podcast has got to be one of my all-time favorites. You got my attention when you spoke about dealing with the suicides of those two kids. You nailed the essential issues it brings up. I'm in the 17th year of working with kids admitted to our unit who either have or want to hurt themselves or someone else, sometimes both. There are so many layers, lines, angles, and dimensions of hurt. Hearing you speak of the room you wish to extend to those kids was a beautiful breath of fresh air. Religion and religious folk have nothing that speaks into these voids and the voids of our culture. This is not so much a criticism, but an expression of my sadness. The only hope in dealing with these voids is helping others connect with a God who loves them. I hope that God awaits these kids and our culture with whispers of love in their lives, and they hear him despite all the cultural and religious clutter. I, like Kyle, see lots of movement here that makes me smile. Great email and great reminder. I think finding some people that will take a look at the 20s. One of the things that came up in the conversation that you sent me this podcast was how despised this generation, younger generation, feels from their elders because yeah. of the different climate they grew up in and their different capabilities. But she assured us there's a lot of kids are not just slackers sitting at home waiting until their 30s to get going. They really are dealing with some core issues of identity and competency and adding life skills. And that's what she does, help people have those kinds of skills that can help them negotiate uncertainty. I just hope one of those skills, how I negotiate uncertainty is inside a presence of Jesus in my life. Without that, Wayne doesn't have enough skills, enough wisdom to negotiate the ever-shifting realities of our broken culture and our broken world. I just don't. But my confidence comes, even when stuff happened with Sarah the way it did, or we continue now to negotiate our trauma. I'm sure some of our listeners have heard what came out of Dallas this weekend. A very famous mega pastor from that area, an author, was exposed as having had a sexual molesting relationship with a 12-year-old girl that lasted 5 years and been hidden all this time. I live with the effects of that with Sarah every day now. I watch what Sarah does to cope with life, what Sarah has to deal with to work past the trauma that she endured and the coping mechanisms that it created and the traumatic brain that needs new neural pathways to give her ways to cope with stuff that comes. And I'm not unforgiving or vengeful toward people who molest children. But I think we're way too easy on them. I do think the price that they exact from someone, and I had lunch with someone today, a pastor actually, and we were talking about this, and he was saying, how can you preach in a pulpit for 40 years and not have the internal experience with Christ that would make you want to go back and fix something so diabolical that you did to someone else, whether it's you pay for the therapy, whether it's whatever. Instead, you keep cloaking yourself in the dynamics of ministry. And this is not just true of this one pastor. I wish that it were. Tony Evans, Dallas, yeah. Same kind of situation, though we don't know what, but some sins caused him to resign. The Kansas City prophetic thing, a lot of exposure there, one with a 14-year-old girl. I mean, it's just... And there's more coming. There's more. I always hear these rumors about a year or two before they actually peak up in the media somewhere, because people know there's a whole lot of corruption in the underbelly of Christianity and Christian leaders who are soft on themselves and soft on each other when they get caught in some kind of sexual indiscretion. And as I was talking to some people about this, because I look at some of these people, and long before their sexual trouble is known, and these guys never seem to repent until they're caught. So it's not like they come to this discovery and are going to make things right.
Yeah.
And the pain is why does it take sexual indiscretion for us to recognize that someone is not full of the life of Jesus? They may be a charismatic speaker. They may know great wisdom. They may have things to say and do. But how does religious arrogance not trip our yuck meters? How do we give a pass to people? I mean, I look at people, and long before there's some scandal known, I'll go, I'm very unsettled with that person. That person does not demonstrate the life of Jesus. They demonstrate a lust for power. So many of our prophets and I use air quotes around prophets, are in this charismatic fury stuff. When I look at the way they present themselves and the anger and their desire to build kingdoms of and they all get a pass on that because they're our bullies. So they're bullies we can kind of live with. And then when they're exposed, it's like, oh my gosh, now what do we do? And it's, why does it take sex for us to recognize that the life of Jesus doesn't dwell there? They may be a practiced Christian. They may have the rituals down. They may have the language down. They may be able to write books about it. What is one man said to me, I don't try to live the stuff I write about. I know how to write to a Christian marketplace. So that's what I do. And those things make my heart hurt for the darkness that surrounds this Christian religion we have. Because unless it's the life of Jesus dwelling in people and making himself known, it's just all so much noise. And eventually when it crumbles, people get seriously, seriously hurt. Most of all, the victims that have lain in quiet because they were terrified, shamed, and intimidated, that they don't even come forward, aren't able to come forward, better said, until after the statute of limitations is long run out. And so, as Sarah said, another one gets away with it. And said, well, he had to resign as pastor. No, he got away with it for a long time. He won't yet get away with it unless he's going to own it in himself and say, okay, I'm paying for whatever therapy she has already had and will have in the future because I destroyed that life. I'm going to fix it. Because if you don't, someone else is going to. And that's fallen to me on Sarah's behalf. And I don't mind that at all. I would happy to make up for whatever some people did, her relatives, to damage her. I'm more than happy to pay for the therapy and stand alongside her and embrace that process. I said to her when we came out, your trauma is our trauma. So I'm in this with you no matter what happens. And I just... That causes great hurt, and I think when it plays back to this generation of young people who look for answers and see the hypocrisy, which Jesus always said, this is the problem. It's hypocrisy. Yeah. It's people who talk one thing and live something else, and when it's unearthed, when it's exposed, it hurts. It reflects on God's reputation with people who don't know God, and that has great impact in our world.
This is where I think the podcast falls short, is because I loved her idea of talking about the idea of skills over pills. right? Let's just not just prescribe them pills. Let's teach them skills to where they can function in life. They can gain this identity capital. They can grow.
I love that too.
But I feel like that falls short. I feel like we need to take that one step further because skills are fine and they're great to have. But if you don't have a conversational, interpersonal relationship with Christ, then I think you get a situation like you do in Dallas, where he had skills. Sure, absolutely, he had skills. But did he have the encounter of the transformational intimacy with Christ? Did he have that conversational, interpersonal relationship with Christ? When I think about that, if I'm developing skills, especially relational skills, identity, capital, I want that to be in the context of the author of Wholehearted Life. And so when I think about, especially in my 20s, it's like, man, God stepped in my early 20s. And I am so incredibly grateful that he did. That counseling retreat that I went on that basically saved my life, that was when I was 20. And then I went and did that YWAM DTS at 21. And then, it just kind of, there was that intro, that collision with, oh no, there's a very real and active and living God that is very much a part of this process. And I got to start to recognize his signatures, his nudges, his fingerprints on the things in my life then and there. If I hadn't been able to see those, if I hadn't had that encounter, I would have been missing, I think, the most valuable piece. And that's where I think even modern psychology falls short is, we can build skills, relational skills and techniques and whatever. That's not downing on those at all. But if they're outside of the context of the love and life of Christ, they're going to fall short. They're only going to get you so far.
But in the podcast sense, she doesn't have that to offer, does she?
No, she doesn't.
And I think oftentimes our religious environment doesn't have that to offer either. We have our disciplines and rituals and doctrines to believe.
Yep.
And that's why my prayer, how is Jesus going to reveal himself to the 20 and 30 somethings? And it's not, I know we got to put a program together. We got to put a message together, a podcast, whatever. No, Jesus gets to reveal himself in their dreams, in their walks in the woods, in their crying out for something more real than what the world has served up to them. That's where I'm praying. I'm praying that Jesus will make himself known and give them the hunger. And then people in my generation and yours, if we're ready to nurture that when we see it, when somebody says, even like you said last time we were together, that they're waking to some kind of revelational reality and maybe using all the wrong terms, but can we recognize the presence of Jesus even under the wrong label enough to nurture that seed so that it can grow and Jesus can fully reveal himself? Because I tell you what, there's nothing about this life I could have coped with if I didn't know, or uncertainty, if I didn't know Jesus was with me. And that's the certainty. Certainty is not how this is going to fall out, whether Sarah comes back or not, or my dad does or not. That was never the issue. The issue was, regardless, he is with me. And he has ways to navigate it. And if I follow him, my life will be changed for the better. If I stay present with him and he present with me. And so those of you that are joining us in prayer, and I've got a lot of emails. I just read one from Mike. I've got a lot from people and phone calls of people just saying, man, I'm going to join you. I'm going to join you in praying for this generation of younger people. And I came with 20s, 30s, 40s. My goodness, I want Jesus to reveal himself in his 50s to people or 60s. It's time for an awakening of who Jesus is, where no one's putting it into a box and franchising it. People awakening to the reality when the world around them is collapsing. And that's, that is not just, I hope that happens someday. That is deep in my heart that we're on a threshold of God making himself known to people who are looking for other options than what the world is throwing at them.
Thank you for traveling with us today on The God Journey. You can join this conversation by visiting thegodjourney.com.